Recorded live high atop the Gaylord St. James building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host Rob Floyd and Phyllis Floyd. Tonight's topic, Last House on the Left. Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the old podcast. Tonight we're talking about Last House on the Left, the notorious Last House on the Left.
It's only a movie. Only a movie.
But before we get into that, got to mention a few things coming up. October's going to be really busy. We're putting on a few events that are going to be really cool in this area down here in the Norfolk, Chesapeake, Virginia Beach area of Virginia. And the first one coming up is Monster Fest at the Chesapeake Central Library on 298 Cedar Road. It's the one-day classic horror convention. And this year, we're celebrating Dr. Madblood's 40th anniversary. If you grew up in this area in the 70s, 80s, 90s, watching late-night TV, and you loved horror movies, you know Dr. Madblood. And you don't want to miss this. It's going to be great. And also, our special guest this year, Miss Veronica Carlson, one of the Hammer Glamour girls who starred along with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee in such films as Dracula Has Risen from the Grave and Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, both of which we will be showing the night of Monster Fest. So check out the Monster Fest website. That's www.monsterfestva.com, or check us out on Facebook for more info on that. And coming after that, because that's not all, on October 17th, Saturday, at the Narrow Expanded Cinema on 1507 Colley Avenue, we're going to be running a Christopher Lee tribute. Up on the big screen, we are going to show Curse of Frankenstein and Horror of Dracula. Can you believe it? Two great Hammer films in a great old historic theater. One price, two films. It's going to be amazing. And that's also in Norfolk, Virginia, in case I didn't mention that. And we got one more big event coming up at the end of the month, the Sunday before Halloween, October 25th. It's Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion and Ellie Quinn presents Terror Tease, a burlesque tribute to horror films. That's right, I said a burlesque tribute to horror films. Psst, hey kid, you like girls? You like horror films? Come on, you don't want to miss this. It's going to be incredible. Burlesque performers performing horror-themed routines to some of your favorite classic horror movies. I can't even begin to describe it. It's going to be cool. This is definitely an 18 and up show. It's live. It's in your face, up on the stage. And also, during intermission, the Cemetery Boys are going to be playing. And we may run some horror trailers up on the big screen. So, who knows what else. Check it out. There is an event on Facebook for Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion and Ellie Quinn Presents on October 25th. And, of course, we'll be talking about it on the Phantasmo Facebook page and Monster Fest and all that other stuff, too. So, that's what's coming up. And, hey, if you want to drop us a line, comment on the podcast, or tell us to shut up, or tell us something else you want to hear us talk about, there's a couple ways you can do it. You can, once again, on Facebook, drop us a line on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page, or you can email us at, what's that email address, Phyllis?
PhantasmoAD@gmail.com.
That's phantasmode@gmail.com. Drop us a line, won't you? Now let's get on with tonight's topic, the infamous Last House on the Left. Long considered by reputation as one of the, grossest, intense movies ever made. A lot of people shy away from it. It doesn't get shown. You're never going to see it on TV, I don't think. I don't know when it's ever been shown in theater other than its original run. But it's not that bad, folks, when you get right down to it and watch it.
I mean, it is bad in that it's horrific. It lets your mind wonder, what exactly is happening. It lets your imagination run away with you. You know, we've talked about this many times, that it's filmed as such that you may not see lots of terrible gore, and you may not see a horrific rape scene that's right in your face, but you know it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of pans off screen a little bit, but
well, yeah. the way it's shot is what has a lot to do with that.
Right,
it's filmed in a documentary style, like you're right there in the middle of it with them. With the it's not shaky cam like they do today, but
thank goodness
it's not steady cam either. The camera's moving, and it's right in the middle of the situation. without being close-ups of their face, like a lot of people try to do and fail miserably with that. But it's gritty. It's kind of realistic feeling.
It puts you in uncomfortable situations. Yeah, I mean, but, it makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah, but you don't see very much. You don't see. I mean, it's not like Saw, and a lot of these other modern horror films that don't get the reputation and don't get the banned in other countries, like Last House was when it came out. It was banned in England and a few other places, and years before it was ever seen or allowed to be seen over there. But a lot of these modern films have far worse gore and far worse intense rape scenes and such like that, and violence, than Last House ever shows. But it makes you think you see more.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole rape scene, or how graphic a rape scene is, or how well it's portrayed on film, has been a hot topic recently. I'm not sure if you know this, but on Game of Thrones recently, and also on Outlander, they both had,
I think
within a week of each other, had some pretty horrific rape scenes. One of them was male on female, and the other one was male on male. And Outlander got a lot of praise for the way it was filmed and the mm-hmm. way it was shown and whatever. But what I'm getting at is, you know, maybe they needed to take a note out of this particular movie.
Something you just said just hit me. Here's how society has changed, okay? Last House, when it came out, was picketed, not shown, was banned all over the place. And this was 1972 when this came out.
The film was literally cut to pieces.
Yeah,
theaters.
Different theaters, the projectionist or the theater owner would take it upon themselves to re-edit it and cut out what they considered the violent gore scenes so they could show it without being having a lot of crap from, you know, the people in the neighborhood or whatever.
Yeah, the audiences.
Now, you just said this horrific rape scene in, was it Outlander?
Outlander.
Mm-hmm. Was praised for the way it was shot, and Last House on the Left was condemned for the way it was shot. Whereas Last House on the Left
was condemned for the way it was shot. It was condemned for the content.
Yeah, but that's the way it was shot, though. You know, and that was in 72, and now we're in 2015, and something that I believe was quite a bit more horrific.
Yeah, very.
It was praised for the way it was shot. Now, I wonder if that was because it was male on male, or just because society has changed on the way it views things. Rape is it goes without saying, it's a horrible thing no matter what, but it's more of a taboo topic, it seems, these days than it was back then, as far as to talk about.
Well, I think it's because people are talking about it more.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we have resources that you didn't have back then. You know, we've got the internet, we have social media, we have all these different ways to talk about things and bring light and shed light on things that are, you know, problems in the world. And I guess that's why people are talking about it.
But Last House, like we were saying, the way it's shot, the camera never pulls away. It never cuts from anything that's going on. The scene plays out right in front of you. But where the camera is in the scene is what's interesting. I think it was the first rape where the girls get into the apartment on the pretense they came to buy some pot to get high before they get to a concert. Mm-hmm. And a guy locks the door behind him, and they're like, oh, crap. And then the bad guys mess with him some, and Krug pushes the girl down, and he starts to get on top of her. But he pushes her down out of camera, and the camera stays on the other girl's reaction that's standing up. So you know what's going on, but you don't see it. You don't see anything.
Right.
You don't see him pull her clothes off. I don't know if in that scene he punches her in the stomach first. I know he does that later on.
Yeah.
You see that, but you don't see, like, her legs up in there. You don't see anything having to do with the rape. You see the other girl's reaction of disbelief, and then it goes to the next scene after that. And it's the same with a lot of the scenes in this film. Let's see, what's the next one? When they force the two girls to have sex with each other.
Right.
I think that's the next.
And it doesn't matter scene. If we're really going chronologically,
well, yeah,
I guess.
It doesn't matter. Watch the film. You'll see it. But it shows them the strip. And even that, it's kind of from the side. It's not dead on. You don't see a whole lot of nudity in this. And then the one girl, they like hugs the other one and says, it's just us here. It's just me and you. There's nobody else, trying to calm her down. And I think it shows them kiss. And then they lay down. and that's it. It doesn't show them actually doing anything.
Right.
But you see the bad guys' reactions, their faces and stuff, and even a couple of the later on, which I think is a very effective scene, where one of the girls is running through the graveyard trying to get away, and Weasel comes up, that's one of the bad guys, comes up behind her, and you see he's got a knife in his hand, and it's, you know, it's a shot from the waist up on her, basically, and he's behind her in the distance, and you see him, a knife in his hand, but as he gets closer, of course, that arm goes out of view of the camera.
Right.
And he gets right behind her, and you see him, you know, make a face and move his shoulder, and you see her react to getting stabbed in the back, but you never see the knife. You never see her get stabbed.
Yeah, you know that she's getting stabbed.
And you see her get stabbed, but you don't see the stabbing.
Right.
You know, and it's very effective the way it's done, but it leads you, you know, you think it's more violent than what's shown, I guess.
Well, again, it just leaves the audience's imagination to fill in the blanks, so to speak, yeah. Which, of course, is one of the most effective filming techniques ever. Oh, yeah,
and that's very old-school filmmaking. That goes back to, like, the Universal Monsters days and stuff like that. What you don't see is more horrific. What you can imagine is more horrific than anything they can show.
Oh, definitely.
But Last House has got this reputation for being this awful, horrible film, and a lot of people today will even say, oh, I'll never watch that. That's such a piece of trash. It's crap. And it's really not. It's a low-budget film.
But it's a great film.
Yeah. And, you know, it's you know, a crime and revenge picture. You know,
I mean, it's not a happy film. It's not going to make you feel good.
No, it came from the 70s. It's not a happy film. None of the grindhouse films in the 70s ended happy, especially if they involve, like, cars or killers. But there's another scene where after the girl gets raped, and this rape is probably the most intense, but still you don't see anything. Krug lays her down, and you can see
Mary,
yeah, you can see that she doesn't have any clothes on, but it's from the side, so you don't see anything. And he lays on top of her, doesn't spread her legs. It's not graphic. Her legs aren't up in the air. He lays on top of her, and the camera is on. It's, you know, kind of slides up on their faces, and it's really creepy and gross. I mean, he's making all these sex faces, and he's kind of drooling on the side of her face, and her face is turned sideways, like towards the camera, but she's looking off in the distance, and she just is gone. She goes somewhere else in her head, and she's just not even there.
Yeah, she's completely disconnected from the situation. Yeah.
And it's really effective.
And you can see that she's disconnected from the situation. It was a really well-done scene. And then when he's done and he gets up and, like, there's all this drool that just kind of, you can see the strings from his mouth to her
gross cheek.
It's disgusting.
And she gets up and just kind of does her pants up and walks away. And the bad guys are kind of like, huh, well, we did that. And she's walking towards the lake, and they just kind of slowly follow her. And she goes and walks into the lake, I guess, to clean herself. It doesn't take her clothes off, though. But
no, she's still so
out of
it.
Yeah, she's in shock. She walks out to the lake, and then Krug takes a gun, and he shoots her. Yeah. Now, in this is like the old cowboy movies. He shoots her, and she flips, you know, gets shot, jerks the reaction and lays in the water. You don't see any blood. You don't see...
Well, you do see a little bit of blood, like, right at first.
I don't remember
just
seeing, like,
a splatter. I saw just
did
a
you?
Bit
okay.
Splatter, yeah.
Well, see, I didn't... We're watching it at the same time on a big screen TV, and it was barely enough to register it for me, but, you know, you saw it.
Yeah.
And there's no exit wound at the back of her head or anything. It's not graphic. It's not in your face. It's amazing that this movie has got the reputation. I can see why it got the reputation at the time it came out, but the way it's held onto it over the years, the reputation is bigger than the movie, which is kind of cool in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know? I think it speaks to the quality of the film. I mean, it's well done.
Which is amazing when you consider that... I forgot to mention, this is our Wes Craven tribute episode, by the way.
In case you haven't figured that out.
Since we lost Wes Craven this past week, who brought us, in addition to Last House on the Left, the Nightmare on Elm Street films, the Scream films, and the Last House on the Left was actually his very first film as writer-director. And he has never went to film school, didn't have any experience in making movies. He and Sean S. Cunningham, who later went on to bring us the Friday the 13th franchise, got together and decided they wanted to make a scary movie. And this is what happened. Wes Craven had seen a movie called The Virgin Spring, which is that a Fellini film? I can't remember. Anyway, Max von Sydow is in it, and it is a Swedish medieval tale of this young girl who gets raped and killed by these three shepherds, these three ruffians, and later on they seek lodging in the house of her parents, and the parents find out that they killed these guys, the ones that killed their daughter, and they seek revenge and kill these three guys. So he thought that this would make a great tale to update and make contemporary, and it turns out it was. It worked, you know, very, very effectively. But he wrote it over, I think, a weekend or 2 week period or something like that, and then they started filming. Not bad for somebody who's never had any school, any film school, for a first effort, and to last this long and to have this much impact on people.
Yeah.
But very, I mean, you know, you're coming out, if you take the context of when it was made in 1972, there weren't many other slasher films. I mean, this might have even started the genre. A lot of people, I think, say it did. Or at least gave it a kick in the pants. Crime horror pictures like this going on. So when this came out, it did shock people, and it did, you know, get banned. And like we said earlier, get cut up and re-edited over and over. And that was a common practice, too. Now, if you go back to the early 70s, even throughout the 70s, when theaters were mostly independently owned and regional, and a movie would go from theater to theater up and down 42nd Street, and then to drive-ins across up north, drive-ins down south, grindhouses in other towns. And the theater owners or the projectionist would cut or re-edit certain scenes just to get it to play. Like if it was in a town where our movies or X movies didn't get a lot of attendance, they would trim it and cut some of the more horrific scenes down so it would play better in their town. And I think it was on some of the extras on the DVD we were watching where Wes Craven and Sean Cunningham said for years they were looking for, trying to get all the prints that they could find to cobble together a complete version. It was been cut up, all the prints had been cut up so bad they couldn't find a complete version.
It's just so amazing. I mean, it's not like I wasn't around during that time, but to think that that happens. I mean, it can't happen now. Can you imagine that trying to go
oh,
on
God,
now?
No.
No, that's not going to happen now. But, you know, to think that the person who put the movie out or the company that put the movie out doesn't have one complete, untouched, unclipped
version. Yeah, there is now. There is now.
Well, I know, but at the time that they had to go around and try and gather up all the pieces so that they could cut back together one complete movie, it's just amazing to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, one, we're so desensitized to that, to violence now, as far as it's on the internet. You see people getting beheaded, getting mugged, getting, you know, attacked. It's on the nightly news at dinner time. And those movies, the movies have gotten more intense and violent and gross and what have you, that it's, you know, it's not as big a deal. It's not as outlandish when something like that happens or comes out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but, you know, there's still the groups that get out there and fuss over it. But you're right. I mean, in general, everybody has become a little desensitized to it, I guess.
Yeah, but if you go back to 1972...
Not the case.
So this was a big to-do, and it didn't set well with a lot of people. If you look up some of the history on it, and, you know, you can see that it was, man, you know, it was, like I said, it was banned in England, cut all to hell. Some theaters wouldn't even show it in their town.
Well, and he was saying, or Wes Craven was saying to one of the extras that people would go see it, and they were, you know, people were so disgusted by it and so sickened by it that they would leave the theater. Some of them would throw up. Some of them, he said that one guy was even reported at having a heart attack.
Oh yeah. And they would leave the theater and, you know, with their face in their hands, 'cause it was just too intense and too gross and all.
Is that where the tagline came from?
No. That kind of came about, from my understanding, when it first came out, it was called, Night of Vengeance, and it didn't play very well. Nobody went to see it. The title didn't do anything. People didn't come to the theater to see it. And then they re-released it. Now, this all happened within weeks and within months, because back then, movies were not released worldwide or across the country at the same time. They were released regionally. And it might open in New York and then move its way down over a couple of months down to the Midwest and down south and across the United States, or it might open in California and move its way this way. The way movies were produced and distributed was quite a bit different back then than it is now. So it was Night of Vengeance, and it was released, and nobody went to see it. So they took it back, and they changed the titles to Krug and Company and re-released it. Nobody went to see it. And then they changed the title to Sex Crime of the Century. And they thought, okay, now we got one people are going to go see. People still didn't go see the movie. I think it was a distributor, I can't remember the guy's name, producer, somebody that knew Sean Cunningham, called him up and said he's got a great title for the movie. If we change the title, he's pretty sure people will go see it. And he said, Last House on the Left. And Sean Cunningham was like, what do you mean, Last House? That doesn't have anything to do with the movie whatsoever. And he said, well, it's got the words themselves have a lot of impact. Last is last. It's final. It's the end.
The death.
Yeah, subconsciously, that's what's in your head when you're hearing it. House, old dark house, creepy old house. It's just, it's something you don't really think about. It just hits you on a, different level. And then left is like left for dead, left by yourself, left at the end. And if you put it all together, Last House on the Left, it gives you kind of an eerie, kind of a creepy thing. And you want to know what it's about. Sex Crime of the Century, you know what it's about. Mm-hmm. You don't want to see that. Last House on the Left,
what could that be?
Yeah. And the way that It's Only a Movie came about is the same guy. He said, you got to put this on the poster. He and his wife were watching it, and she kept hiding her face when something would happen. And he turned to her and said, honey, it's only a movie. Don't worry. So that's where that it's only a movie, only a movie, only a movie, where that came about. And a lot of films since then over the years have used that. But Last House was the first one that had it. So there you go. See, you learned something, kids. Now, hey, look, we got to talk about the people that made it a little bit. it was produced by Sean Cunningham, like we said earlier, who went on to do the Friday the 13th movies. And one of the production assistants, Steve Miner, who went on to direct Friday the 13th 2 and 3 and House and a few other movies, worked on it, written and directed by Wes Craven, also edited by Wes Craven. They shot the film in Sean Cunningham's mom's backyard and in her house some.
Can you imagine if mom walks out and sees this happening? She must have been either really cool with this whole thing or totally oblivious.
Yeah. I'm probably a little bit of both,
Yeah, maybe.
Now, right off the top, we've got David Hess as Krug, the leader of the bad guys, who played really just a despicable son of a bitch in this movie.
Father of the year there.
Yeah. And his... Mark Schiffler, who played his son, Junior, who they say in some of the exposition over the police report over the radio that he hooked his son on heroin to control him. So he's got his son hooked on heroin, and he's doing all this despicable stuff and got him involved in these crimes. So like you said, yeah, father of the year. Fred Lincoln, who plays Fred the Weasel Podowski, who plays pretty much a creepy, evil...
Weasley guy,
yeah. Has a switchblade, and Fred Lincoln came from... He actually was working on Broadway before this, doing plays and such, and off Broadway. And then somebody he knew said, "Hey, do you want to get into movies? You want to have sex on film and get paid for it?" And he's like, "Hell yeah!" So he got into porn, and he did a lot of porn in the 70s, and then went into producing and directing. And I think he was doing that through the 80s and 90s, as far as I know. And then going down the list, we got Jeremy Rain, who was Sadie, Krug's girlfriend, or the gang's girlfriend, was married to Richard Dreyfuss for a number of years and had a couple kids with him. And
were they married at this time when they filmed
it? I'm not sure if it was at this time or after this, because she was only like 21 or 22.
Yeah.
But she's supposed to be playing...
they said that she was supposed to be like 40, yeah, she was way too young.
Yeah, so she just, did her makeup and her hair and just played it really... gritty. And that's the bad guys. Then it cannot fail to mention that one of the sheriff and the deputy, who are pretty much comic relief for the film and really don't even need to be there much, but the deputy, played by Martin Cove, who you know him, you love him, the karate teacher, bad guy in Karate Kid from Cobra Kai. Sweep the leg. And I think he was in Rambo 2 also.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Marty Cove playing Barney Fife, pretty much. Now, that's the thing I want to bring up to you. You're watching this horrific movie, all this violence and crime is happening, and then you've got...
Then you meet the bumbling police officers.
You've got these comedy relief bits in between, and I don't know if it's supposed to...
Lighten the mood, maybe?
Give you a break, give your senses a break was the intention, but it kind of takes me out of what's happening, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't make me relax, like, you know, it's just like, oh, man, I was watching this movie and now I'm somewhere else, you know?
Yeah. Well, they do a really good job of playing pretty much bumbling idiots, you know?
It's like two Barneys.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And the music does that, too. In some instances, it does what it was meant to do, is play as a counterpoint to what's going on. And incidentally, all the music was done by David Hess Krug. He was also a musician for a number of years and wrote, wrote some songs for Elvis and had a minor hit himself before that in the 60s, and wrote for some other people too, like Andy Williams and stuff like that.
Wow.
And here he is playing Krug, but Wes Craven and Cunningham find out that he was a musician and said, hey, you want to do the music for the movie? And he's like, sure. So all of the songs and the music in the film are written and played and sang by David Hess also. And in the scenes where the violence is happening to the girls, and then it has this kind of these sweet, soft melodies and songs, it does give kind of a weird counterpoint and kind of takes your senses back and forth. And that's fun. That works great, I think. You know, I see where they were coming from and it works fine. But then you get to where they're riding it, and this is my favorite song in the movie.
Good Lord.
Where the bad guys are riding down the highway and they got the girls in the trunk and they're in a convertible and Sadie is sitting on top of Krug and they're apparently having sex while the car is moving and they're just talking to everybody else in the car. And then this song is this song is playing. And the lyrics tell the story of the bad guys and the characters and what they're doing, and it's just happy and bouncy.
The weird thing is that, yeah, the lyrics are telling the story of these characters and what's going on, but at the same point, there's dialogue in the movie. So, I don't hear very well, for those of you who don't know me, and I always watch with closed captions. It was very distracting to try and read the closed captions and listen to different lyrics that are in the song, because once I realized that the lyrics were actually talking about the characters in the movie, I mean, their names are in the song. It's not like random characters. It's these characters.
It's like Sadie and Krug and Junior and we.
Yes. And once I realized that, then I had to pay attention. You know, I wanted to see what the lyrics were. It was driving me crazy.
And if you want to pay attention, go on Amazon. The soundtrack is on there. You can order it now.
Oh, Lord.
And I think I want that for Christmas, by the way, Phyllis.
I don't.
I want the Last House on the Left soundtrack for Christmas.
Don't hold your breath.
I'll get it myself, damn it. Man, but yeah, it's, not only did he do the music, but things that I've heard from the making of the film, everybody did everything else too. Like if one of the actors wasn't in the scene, they might be holding the sound. The microphone, the sound boom, you know, or everybody kind of pitched in and helped out where they could because it was such a low budget and a group effort to make the film. I mean, even when it was first written, when Wes Craven first wrote it, it was supposed to be a lot more intense, a lot more graphic, and was intended to be a hardcore porn film with a lot of violence and stuff in it. And he said, you know, at the time he was young and, you know, was thinking about breaking all the barriers down. And then the cast, who had already committed to do that film, I don't think the girl played Mary knew what was going on, but they all committed to do that after they read the script. And I guess, I don't know how many different versions he went through the script, but they said, you know, this is a good enough story without the sex in it. And they thought it would, you know, it would play, it would work better that way. And it did, because if they would have made it as a porn, it would have got got a footnote and, you know, is swept under the rug and wouldn't have played in as many places. Mm-hmm. But without the hardcore sex, it played all over the place. Everybody's seen it. Everybody knows about it. And if you haven't seen it, you do know about it and you want to see it. So there it is. Oh, one of the other things we wanted to bring up. Now, jumping around, we do this a lot. The podcast is not linear, folks.
I wouldn't know how to be.
But there's one scene that's kind of, and not off-putting, but kind of weird in the film. And this is probably one of the scenes that is like maybe the grossest in the film. The most graphic is after they kill, was it Phyllis is the name? Yeah, the character's name is Phyllis.
Hey, you remember.
Yay. They stab her in the back. She crawls away, like we talked earlier. And they follow her, the three main bad guys, and they catch up to her. And then Weasel starts to stab her some more. And it's pretty violent the way he's stabbing her. But all you see is him moving his arm down to stab her. You don't see him the knife going in.
You never see a knife.
And
going
then,
in, yeah.
Yeah, and then Sadie takes a knife and she starts stabbing her when she's laying down on the ground. The same thing. You just see Sadie. You see some blood flick on her face. That's about it. And then the camera goes down, pans down, and you do see Sadie like at Phyllis's abdomen, and it's all blood all over her hands, and she starts pulling like intestines out. And of course, you know, it's like the old trick where they fill condoms with sausage and fake blood and peanut butter and all that stuff, so it looks like intestines are in there. And it's really gross, but it's only what, less than a second?
Yeah,
on,
it was
on
hardly
camera.
Any time. Yeah, the deleted scenes show her playing in that thing for probably a full minute, but they only have a second or two in the actual film.
If that much. So that's the most intense graphic thing you see in the film. All the other scenes in it are shot, like we said earlier, so you think you see more. Yeah. In fact, the most intense scene, your favorite, the one that gets you the most, and I think it gets me too, is at the very end, Junior has had enough of Krug, and he has the gun, and he's pulled it on David Hess, and he's like, I'll shoot you, and Krug's like, you won't shoot me, you know, go ahead, shoot me. No, you won't do it. You know what I want you to do? Put the gun in your mouth. He's like, no, put the gun in your mouth. And at this point, the camera's just on Krug's face.
Yeah, you don't even see Junior anymore.
You just hear him, like, crying off camera. He's like, put the gun in your mouth. Blow your brains out. Bam! And when the gun goes off, Krug's, his eyes close for, like, a second, and he opens them back up. And it happens. There's a build-up, but then it happens so quick. It's a good jump scare, a good jolt.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you watch Krug, and David Hess does an amazing job there. I mean, it's you feel that he means it, and you can't believe it. You don't understand how can a father tell his son that this is what he wants to happen, you know? And you wonder just for a split second when he closes his eyes, is he sorry that he convinced him to do that, mm-hmm. or is he just kind of,
well,
thank God that's over? You don't know.
Yeah, well, that's what I was getting at a minute ago, and I went. Off on a little tangent, but after they disembowel Phyllis, the three of them stand up and they're looking at her, down at her, and the looks on their faces is like, ugh, man.
Did we really just do that?
Yeah, it's like it just hits them that they can't believe they just did that. So, and the three of them kind of walk down to the lake, and, you know, they take off their shirts, and she gets in the water. They're trying to wash all the blood off of them and clean what they just did off of them.
Mm-hmm.
That look doesn't last long.
No.
You know.
It's just a little bit where, you know, the audience almost feels a little sympathy for them. You know, like, I can't believe they just did that either. Like, you're with them. I can't believe you just did that.
Yeah.
Are you feeling sorry for the fact that you did it? I don't know. But yeah, so you wonder there when Junior shoots himself, if David Hess...
Now,
Krug
in between that,
anything.
After they clean themselves up, before Junior shoots himself, they do clean themselves up, comb their hair, put on suits, and change their clothes to look nicer.
Yeah, we never did get to the end of the movie, did we?
And they go up to the house where their car broke down earlier, and they take the girls out of the trunk, and they take them into the woods where all this stuff happens.
And guess whose house it is?
It breaks down right in front of Mary's house.
Mom and Dad are home, worried where their daughter is.
And the house is off the road, so that they can't see the car. So they decide, you know, they've killed the girls and the car's broke down. They go up to the house and ask them if they could take them to the garage to fix the car, or call somebody to come tow the car, and I think their phone's down,
yeah,
or something, and the or the place is closed. It's after dark. The place is closed, so they say, well, you know, you can just stay here tonight. We'll take you in the morning. We got plenty of room. And they have the bad guys at the house. They have dinner. They feed them dinner, and this is where the parents start to go, They notice the way they're eating, which is not very civilized.
Yeah, not very good table manners.
No, and Weasel is flirting with the mom
right next to dad.
Yeah, and the dad notices when Krug reaches over for something, he sees bite marks on his wrist, which is kind of unusual for anybody. So after dinner, they all go to bed, and Junior, Krug hasn't given him his fix, so he's having the withdrawals. And he's in the bathroom dry heaving and trying to throw up. And the mom of the house goes and asks if he's okay. Puts him to bed in the room. And they gave him two rooms, but they're all sleeping in the one room for some reason.
Which happens to be Mary's room.
Yeah.
And they see Mary's picture and they're all kind of like, oh, guess who lives here? And, you know, they can't believe that they're in the house, Mary's house, they just killed.
And they're like, well, we'll just sleep it off and get, you know, get away in the morning.
Yeah. Well, one key thing that when mom goes to help Junior in the bathroom, she sees a necklace.
Oh, yeah, that Junior's wearing that they just gave to Mary the day before. Yeah.
Yeah. They see the necklace they gave to Mary on for her birthday is now on Junior's neck. And so she starts to really get suspicious.
Yeah. So she puts Junior to bed in that room and they have their luggage in the other room. And she hears them talking through the door, and Junior's asking Krug for his fix, and he says, I should have left you down in the lake with their kid that we killed, or something like that.
Yeah, and then one of them's like, you know, keep quiet if they ever find out that we're the ones that killed their daughter.
Yeah, and the mom's like, oh! And then she starts looking through their luggage in the other room. She sees the bloody clothes and kind of gets it. And then she goes to get the father, and they go out, you know, they sneak outside, and they go down to the lake, and they find Mary and bring her back to the house. And decide to get their revenge. And the mom is in the I guess living room or something, having a drink, and the father's down in the basement, and Weasel can't sleep. He had a nightmare about them finding out. And he gets up and he goes in there and starts flirting with the mom, and she starts flirting back with him and saying that, oh, my husband never understood me, can never take care of me like a real man like you, and playing right into his ego. And they go outside.
They go outside down to the lake.
Well, not the same lake. Because they don't go out in the woods. No, because that lake was out in the woods. They just go out in their backyard down by the pond or the lake.
Okay.
How it comes up in their backyard. And she says something again about her husband not being able to satisfy her. And Weasel says, oh, I could, you know, satisfy a woman like you with both hands tied behind my back. And she's like, oh, really? That's, you know, would be a fantasy of mine. And he's like, she's like, but nobody could really do that. He said, yeah, I could. Here, tie me up. She's like, no, I couldn't do that. He says, yeah, do it. Play into his ego. So she ties his hands behind his back, and they make out a little bit, and she starts to go down on him, and she gets down to her knees, unzips his pants, and starts to go to work, and then all of a sudden he starts screaming in pain, and she bit it off right there. And then she goes down the lake and spits it out, which... They say that you see her spit it out. I didn't see her spit it out.
I didn't see it either. And I was looking because I had always heard that, but I didn't see it.
So she's just getting water up to dry, rinse her mouth out, and Weasel's bleeding out. While this is going on, Krug is woken up, and the father has come into the room and taken his gun and is in the other room, and he has booby-trapped the house. He put shaving cream on the floor so it will slip and fall when he comes out. He put a tripwire in one doorway. Electrified one of the doorknobs, and he's all set. Well, Krug, you know, falls down. All this happens to him. The father shoots in the dark in the room. He shoots one. He has a shotgun, a double barrel, and he shoots one time. I think he gets Krug in the shoulder a little bit, but that's it. So they're brawling in the living room, and of course Krug gets the best of him because he's a younger guy and he's violent and tough. And then Junior comes out with the gun and distracts Krug, and while they're going through the, you know, put the gun in your mouth, the father disappears. And as soon as after Junior shoots himself, this is great, you hear,
I love the sound effects.
Thank you. And Krug looks around like, what the hell is that sound? And he goes over to the basement, doors open, and he looks down to here. And you see the father coming up the stairs with a chainsaw, and Krug's like, oh, shit. And he shuts the door and leans against the door, which is dumb.
Shuts and leans against the door, because the chainsaw's not going to go through wood. Why would it do that?
Yeah. So the father cuts through the door, and Krug runs into the other room. And this is interesting, because I think this is one of the first times that a chainsaw has been used on film, in a horror film, crime film, for this type of thing. Last on Left came out in 1972, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre didn't come out until 1974. So, you know, you kind of wonder, did Toby Hooper see this and go, hey, that's a neat idea? Because Ed Gein was, I don't think, was known for using a chainsaw.
I've never heard it.
Yeah, so anyway, they have this chainsaw battle against furniture, and guess what? Chainsaw wins, and the movie ends. But you don't see the chainsaw cut Krug up. You see,
the police officer breaks in, or the sheriff, I guess, yeah, comes in,
and Krug
and
hits
tells
the wall.
Him, no, don't do it.
And also, too, Krug is on the ground, slides down the wall, and he's just like beyond the doorway, the way the camera's looking. So you see Krug's feet, and you see the father going behind the door with the chainsaw.
Right.
Once again, it's shot great, you know, that you think you see more.
Well, the little synopsis thing on IMDb says distinctly that the dad beheads Krug, but I don't know how they know that, because we don't see that.
Yeah, there was no fake head prop made.
Yeah. I'm not sure where they got that from, but in any case, that's what it said. I found that interesting.
I thought he just, the way he was coming down with a chainsaw, I thought it looks like he just maybe came down his shoulder right into his chest or something.
Yeah.
But you don't see any of that. You see a little blood splatter on the sheriff's face, maybe a little on the dad.
Yeah. Oh, we didn't cover Sadie. Well, she ran out.
Well, yeah, while this is going on, Sadie runs out the back door with a knife. The mother jumps her, and Sadie drops a knife. They roll around and fight a little bit, and then Sadie gets up and starts running, and the mother picks the knife up. Sadie, it's dark. It's supposed to be dark. It's shot day for night with filters and stuff. So it's supposed to be really dark, middle of the night. Sadie runs into the pool, and she's trying
to... Which is really disgusting. It's like the scum-filled family pool.
Yeah, apparently the actual pool hadn't been cleaned in years. So Jeremy Rayne had to jump in this nasty, disgusting pool and open her mouth. So when when she's trying to get out, the mother slashes her throat, and of course she squeezes the blood and pack, and it comes out of her mouth, and oozes out of her throat. So, you know, hey, props to her for being a trooper there.
Yeah,
no kidding. So the parents have got their revenge and killed the bad guys that killed their child. And that's the movie.
And the movie's over.
And it just goes, it fades to black, and you get some of the music after that. But I can't say enough, it's amazing to me how the reputation of this film over the years has gone on beyond the film itself, because sitting back and watching it again recently, it's gritty, and I can't say it's disturbing.
Parts of it are disturbing.
I can see why it would be disturbing, but maybe I've seen it a few times and I'm watching it more analytically at this last time, especially in comparison to a lot of other films that have come out since then that have really intense rape scenes, like that one with Jodie Foster, where she, it's a court case, but it flashes back and shows her, like, she was gang raped in a bar. And that was pretty brutal and pretty graphic. And there's been other ones. During the same time period in the 70s, I Spit on Your Grave, the rape scenes in that were brutal and uncomfortable to watch. And that doesn't have as bad a reputation, I don't think, as Last House does. It might. They may be neck and neck, but it's weird. That had some pretty graphic scenes. But even since then, the violent stuff from all the slasher flicks and the recent torture porn movies, like Hostel and Saw and those type things, are much nastier and violent and more graphic than anything Last House could. Even the stuff that was cut out of Last House doesn't even compare to those. But it's cool, the reputation that has preceded this little film for, God, what, over 40 years now, and people still have this stigma or taboo about not wanting to see it, or that how rough a film it is. And all I can say is watch it. You know, get a copy of it and check it. Don't watch the remake.
Well, you can if you want to compare.
Well, you can. We saw the remake a few years ago and don't remember much about it. That's how effective it was. The only thing I remember about it is the bad guys weren't threatening to me. They looked too young and too pretty. They didn't look like they had any mileage on them. You know, like they were any kind of a threat as people.
Well, I guess there is some, validity to maybe having the normal guy who's actually, you know, a horrible criminal, you know. I mean, that's true. There are people out there, looks like a normal guy. You always hear the people on the radio or, you know, on the news. Oh, he was such a nice guy.
Well, serial killers typically are just the guy next door.
Well, I know.
You know, but...
And, I mean, I agree with you. I think that, you know, for this movie, I felt like the story called for someone who just looks really...
Well, they're supposed to be have been in and out of prison.
Yes.
And, you know, being on the road. And when they clean themselves up, it's supposed to be a transition.
Right, right, right.
You know, and...
No, I mean, I agree with you. I was just trying to give a little bit for... I don't actually remember a whole lot at all about the remake. It didn't make much of an impression on me at all.
So
regardless.
I definitely recommend seeing the original Last House on the Left. The remake you can watch if you want. I can't say anything about it. But to bring it up real quick, you say... Now, that's my big argument for Halloween. Mm. The normal person next door as opposed to the, you know, creepy, big, creepy guy. The original Halloween, why that was so effective to me is... When at the very beginning, the first scene, in the clown suit, and he kills his sister, and then the parents come home, he's standing in the yard in the clown suit with the bloody knife, and they pull the mask off of him, and this is this sweet, angelic face, this young kid, and you're wondering, and the parents look like they're pretty normal, suburban, you know, folks. How did this happen? Why is he evil like this? What made him snap and do this? Because he's just pure evil. There was no motivation. That's the point of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, Rob Zombie's remake, which, well-made film, I like watching his films, but given Michael all this backstory of coming from an abused home and being this disturbed kid and having this abusive stepfather and his mom's a stripper and all this stuff coming on and these people picking on him and he dissected animals and took pictures of it, well, of course he's going to be screwed up for life. You know, it's there's no mystery there. There's nothing creepy. And then... When he's an adult, they've got, instead of just an average height, 6 foot guy, average build playing it, who's unstoppable, to me, that's scary. You know, they've got this monster, Tyler Mayne, I think, played him. Isn't that the guy?
I can't remember.
This big monster of a guy that's, you know, almost 7 feet tall and huge. Of course, I mean, you know, he's scary without any of the mystery behind him, but without being crazy, without wearing the mask. It just doesn't, it's not as effective to me. It doesn't work that way. And so it's just the opposite there is with this. With this, they're average, regular people, but they're edgy. You know, the casting on the original was perfect. Krug, Weasel, Sadie, you know, they just, and Junior, they looked like, and they played these down and out career criminal folks that you didn't want to mess with. And in the remake, I didn't feel that. So, right.
Yes, that is very true. I agree.
There's my tangent on Halloween, which could be a total another episode entirely. But we're talking about Last House, and I think we're almost done.
Indeed. Oh, one thing we haven't touched on, of course, maybe you'll get there, and I haven't waited long enough. I'm not very patient. Krug, the whole name thing.
Hmm. Well, yeah, Krug, I don't know where he picked that name from, but years later, when he does Nightmare, well, Wes Craven does Nightmare on Elm Street, he kept the name and just made it Kruger, and because he just liked the sound of the name, I think, Krug. Mm-hmm. It just had a feeling to it. So Freddy Krueger came from Krug from
Those
Last House.
Killers of children.
Yes.
Teenage and children.
There you go. So
it's a theme. Maybe Wes Craven didn't like teenagers.
Get off my lawn! man, well, you know, hey, here's to Wes Craven. Gave us a lot of good scares over the years and a lot, you know, quite a few horror films. At least the first in the series of each of the films he gave us. And it's sorry, you know, sad thing that we lost him this past week, but he, you know, his work lives on and we can watch it anytime we want. And I urge you to, you know, go out and see, you know, get Last House on the Left. It's on DVD. It's not that hard to find. There's a couple different releases of it, and each of the different DVD releases does have different extras.
And be different, sure to watch them.
Yeah, and different interviews and stuff. So check those out, too, because that gives you some insight. And oh, that's what I meant to bring up, too.
Oh, that book.
That book. Man. a few years ago, I was lucky enough to be at a friend's house who had this book. And I think it was called, Last House on the Left or Wes Craven's?
It's Wes Craven's Last House on the Left.
Making of or something like that.
Hang on, I'll get the title while you're talking.
Okay. But man, it was a fantastic book. It was so in-depth and so it covered everything. And it was, you know, anecdotes from people who were there, crew, cast, Wes Craven, Sean Cunningham, everybody. And it covered every aspect of the movie from the idea they had of making it all through production and the release of it and after the release of it and the legacy of it since then. Man, I would like to get a copy of that book and read it again. It was really fantastic, and I'd love, you know, more movies had books like of this quality about them. It'd be fantastic.
It's called Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, The Making of a Cult Classic by David, I don't know if I can pronounce that, Skulkin, maybe?
Okay. So it is on Amazon.
You can get it on Amazon.
It's out of print, though.
It's out of print, but I think the cheapest one is like $38 used.
Okay, well, don't get that one, because I'm going to get that one. You can get the next copy. That would be a nice Christmas present, too. Hint, 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 Santa.
Okay, that's already on your wish list, though. So you might actually get that. I don't have to listen to that.
Looks like I'm on my own with the soundtrack. So
yeah, soundtrack's kind of annoying to me, but that's okay.
So anyway, once again, to wrap up, hey, see the movie. Seek it out. Find it. Judge for yourself whether it deserves the reputation, you know, and whether you like it or not. Like I said, if you put yourself in the context of 1972 and that kind of mindset and look what else was going on, sure. If you watch it alongside other horror movies that have been out since then, it's really not that bad. But it is shot in a different way than a lot of them are these days. So
yeah,
check out the movie.
Much better.
Read the book. Listen to the soundtrack.
Oh, Lord.
I think that's about it. Till next time.
That's all I got.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.